Hey, Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Regular listeners of this program will already be familiar with Dr. James Konka from previous conversations. I value our time with him in particular for his expertise, his commitment to a livable future, his deep understanding of energy issues, and his background with nuclear power. By the way, that background has never been as a speaker or representative for the nuclear industry. Dr. Konka's 30-plus years of experience is in research and academia. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Konka about the issue of nuclear waste, how that fits into our decision-making process as to whether nuclear power should be a part of our carbon-free energy future. So here we go. Once again, we're really pleased to have Dr. James Konka on Climate Talk today. Jim, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome. This is great.
So I just want to set the stage here a little bit, the big picture stage. So we know since, let's say 1800, 1820, that the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere has increased by about 50%. And the result of that is that the Earth is getting warmer and that the climate is changing. And that carbon dioxide comes from fossil fuels, primarily, not exclusively, but primarily. And so that fossil fuel carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is what's making the Earth warmer. Right now, worldwide, about 80% of the energy we use, give or take, is from fossil fuels. And so if we're going to replace those fossil fuels, it represents, by any measure, a massive challenge to replace 80% of the world's energy with something other than fossil fuels. So given that setting, just briefly, give me your thoughts about how do we do that transition?
Well, you got to get rid of fossil fuels. I mean, that's number one, right? So stop building new fossil fuel plants. The problem is we keep building new fossil fuel plants, especially worldwide, because there's about 2 billion people that need more energy in order to lift them up out of poverty. And if you don't do that, the only way to do that is to give them about 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year. Okay. And primarily we do that with coal, because if you're a poor country and you have no infrastructure, coal is the easiest thing to put in place. It's not the best. It's not the cheapest. It's simply the easiest if you have no existing infrastructure. So that's what's happening in Southern Asia and in Africa in huge amounts. Now, Germany's still building new coal. That's another story. And then, China is still building new coal to replace their old coal. We are not building new coal. We've been building new gas, however, to replace coal in this country, which has been very good. But the problem is gas is still a fossil fuel. It produces over half the amount of CO2 as coal, but it doesn't produce a lot of the other nasty stuff like mercury and sulfur and other things like that. So that's great. The problem is coal was our base. Okay, it used to be about 45% of our electricity production in this country up until about 2010 when we started to close coal plants. We've closed half of our coal plants, and we're going to close the next half by 2030. We are not replacing it with any base load, something that just runs all the time and gives you a lot of power. And that's nuclear. Nuclear just runs all the time, gives a lot of power. It's safe as all get out, safer than any of the other energy sources, on any measure, by any measure, better on the environment, better on people. So we should be replacing coal with nuclear, okay? And then, the amount of other renewables you bring on, you still have this base load of power you can depend on no matter what the weather is outside, okay? Same thing, that coal basically didn't depend on the weather. Although if it got really cold, coal could not function very well. And that's what happened in Texas last year. So we need nuclear. The problem is everyone's afraid of nuclear for no good reason. Okay, it was all propaganda for 70 years. I hate, it's ridiculous. I've dealt with nuclear for 40 years now. I've handled nuclear waste for 40 years. It's not that dangerous. I mean, no one's ever died from nuclear waste, ever. Okay. Now the Soviets, we can't tell because they were idiots. They still are idiots. And, they could have killed a bunch of people. We'll never know. But the rest of the world, nuclear has never killed anyone. Nuclear power. Okay, now nuclear weapons, completely different. Nuclear weapons have nothing to do with nuclear power. You can't make a nuclear weapon out of spent fuel from a commercial reactor, contrary to what everyone thinks, contrary to what all the anti-nuclear people think. You can't do that, and I'll talk about why.
Let me just interject a quick question here. So what I'm hearing you say is that nuclear power is a way of creating a baseline source of electricity that can make up for the variability of wind and solar primarily. So just let me ask you this. Is there any other option available to us other than making up that baseline with nuclear power?
No. Because we'll never have the storage to do it. And the only good storage we have, 97% of the electricity storage or energy storage in the world is pumped hydro. And every time we propose to put a pumped hydro system in America, it gets shot down by the public. Okay, so they don't understand these issues. It's like, well, how are you going to store the renewable energy? And storing renewable energy doesn't make wind better. It just makes it more flexible. Okay, so the idea that, okay, you can store solar energy, the sun goes down, you can use it, but you can't store it for very long. And we need to store seasonally. We need to, like, you know, in the wintertime, solar doesn't produce very much and wind doesn't produce very much. And so, you know, so you can't store that energy, you know, until next spring. I mean, that doesn't, you know, it's like, wait a second. There are some realities you have to be aware of. Now, you need to bring wind and bring solar up. You need to put them in the right place. There are right places and wrong places. Okay. Washington State is the wrong place for wind. Absolutely. A useless thing to put in Washington State is wind. Okay. But we're doing it all over the place.
Okay. Let me ask you another quick question here. Apologize for the interruption. But
no.
So we're going to be talking about nuclear quite a bit today, maybe mostly.
Right.
And a lot of our listeners probably, if push came to shove, they would say they are opposed to nuclear power. And you made reference to propaganda. So my guess is that the majority of our listeners who are worried about adopting nuclear power are like, did I really fall for propaganda? So talk about the propaganda a little bit. I mean, if there's propaganda, that implies a propagandist, somebody who wants to put the propaganda out there. So where did this propaganda come from? And why is it that what most people believe based on propaganda?
Right. The first real anti-nuclear stuff came in the 40s and 50s. Okay. It was a response to, of course, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it was a response to the idea of above ground nuclear tests and the Cold War. So the whole idea that, you know, how dangerous is radiation? We've known that since the 30s. Okay. Nothing has changed. So by the end of the 30s, we realized that anything above about 20 rem per year or 0.2 sieverts per year, was no problem. Okay. There was no excess cancers. Radiation does not cause inherited mutations. We've shown that over and over again. So it was no big deal. So 20 rem is a good, you know, a good threshold below which you don't have to worry about, above which you need to worry about it. The problem is, this threshold idea didn't sit well with people who wanted to abolish nuclear, wanted to stop above ground nuclear tests, especially the Soviets and the Chinese. They wanted to stop the United States from above ground nuclear testing. And so they bought into this idea that was propagated by the Rockefeller Foundation and a couple of fairly unethical scientists at the time, that there was no safe threshold of radiation below which you didn't have to worry about it. And they called that the linear no threshold dose hypothesis. Okay. And all they had was effects of high levels of radiation, because there are no effects of low level radiation. And they just drew a straight line to zero and said, okay, everything is bad. Right down to zero, which is absurd, because we live in a background environment of radiation. We evolved in a background environment of radiation.
And okay, let me ask you a quick question here. So you've got this 20 rem, I think, of radiation below which there's no demonstrated health issues. So what is the normal background radiation that most of us are subject to most of the time? How much
anywhere,
is it?
Anywhere from about 500 millirem or 0.5 rem to 10 to 20 rem. So that's why this threshold was about 20 rem, because there are places on Earth that have 20 rem. Okay. There's no excess cancers there. We know that. The Japanese bomb survivors that got, you know, just blasted with radiation, anyone that was below 20 rem, there was no effect.
Okay? Gotcha.
And we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that were subjected to radiation at low levels, and there's never been an effect below about 20 rem. So if you wanted to back off a little bit and say 10 rem, okay, we'll do 10 rem, because there's lots of places on Earth that have 10 rem. And that would be fantastic. It would lower the cost of nuclear. It would encourage more radiological medical therapies. People are afraid to get therapy because they're afraid of radiation. It's like, wait a second, you're dying of cancer and you're worried about low levels of radiation? What are you, crazy? And yeah, well, they're scared because they've been told to be scared over and over and over again. So that's where it started, of course. And of course, the world adopted the linear no threshold dose hypothesis. And people don't know that term, of course, but they know the effect. The effect is be very afraid of radiation of any sort. So when you look at the only three nuclear accidents in history, in terms of, you know, commercial power, you have Chernobyl, which was a weapons reactor, by the way. People don't remember that. Okay. It was to produce plutonium for weapons. Okay. It also produced power, but it was produce a ton of plutonium, and it was a bad reactor.
Let me interject real quick again here too, because Chernobyl's back in the news these days, of course, because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Right.
And so I thought that Chernobyl was just mothballed and was done, but apparently
it's done. It's dead. I mean, it's been cooling off for 35 years. At Chernobyl, the heat generated by a spent fuel assembly at Chernobyl melted is about the same as 700-watt bulbs, you know, old-fashioned bulbs. I mean, yeah, not a lot. It's not going to melt anything. It's not going to blow up. There's no energy left, okay? There's some radiation. You don't want to be right in the melted core. But there's no risk to anyone. And they started digging into the exclusion zone. And again, there isn't enough radiation there to harm them. Everyone's upset. Oh, they're going to get cancer. No, they're not going to get cancer. We know this, okay? No one's gotten cancer after the original few that got cancer from fighting the fire at Chernobyl, actually right in the reactor core. So, you know, there were 56 people died as a result of Chernobyl, not thousands, not hundreds of thousands. Those are nonsense numbers. No one outside of Chernobyl itself was affected because they didn't get enough radiation. So, you know, so again, everything you know about that is wrong. So when the Russians invaded, you know, Ukraine, and they came down to Chernobyl, a lot of people, myself included, said, oh my God, they're gonna make a strategic issue of Chernobyl, right? Turns out, no, they had no clue what Chernobyl was. I talked to people from the International Atomic Energy Agency who talked to the people at Chernobyl, the workers at Chernobyl. The Russians came in. They had never heard the word Chernobyl.
Wow.
They didn't know what it was. They didn't know it was radioactive. They didn't know there was a problem in 1986. That's the kind of propaganda inside Russia that Putin's team does. Don't want to talk about Chernobyl because it was an embarrassment for the Soviet Union. Don't want to talk about it. Don't want to teach it. So, you know. So that was funny. It's like, wait a second, they were just clueless. It was just on the way to Kyiv.
Yeah, gotcha.
So, yeah.
Okay, so that's one of three nuclear accidents. What about the other two? What's the story on those?
Fukushima, of course, again, not enough was released. No one got enough dose. Unlike Chernobyl, the Japanese government told everyone what happened like the minute after it happened. Okay, the Russians waited weeks. Okay, and so there was a little bit of dose. So, but in Fukushima, there was no problem. No one's died from radiation. No one's going to die from radiation. There wasn't enough, and the evacuation unfortunately was done badly because of this fear. So they shut down all their nukes, which was stupid because only 15 of them were out of 55 were ever even in danger of a tsunami. So they should have shut down those until they, you know, got their act together. But, you know, but again, Fukushima was a horrible accident. No one died from radiation. But it was their fault. Okay. It was hubris and greed. NRC would never have licensed Fukushima to start to begin with. Never would have granted them a license because their seawall was crap. Their backup generation was crap. And we'd been telling them for years, you know, this is not a good situation. And they just ignored us. Okay. So, you know, but no one died.
So one of the things I understand about Fukushima was that people had told them that their seawall was not adequate in the event of a major tsunami.
Right.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. And they invented the word tsunami. I mean, they have the best, they have the best tsunami warning system in the world. Okay. But they just ignored it when they came to their seawalls, which is like, what are you doing? How absurd. So that was completely avoidable. If they had a reasonable seawall, nothing would have happened.
Okay. And I did think of something. I wanted to go back real quick to Chernobyl for a second. So one of the things that happened in the 80s when they had that meltdown or whatever it was there, there was a lot of concern about a radioactive cloud going over other parts of Europe, I think Sweden and a lot of places like that. So was that a legitimate concern?
It was a legitimate concern, but it ended up not being anything. The cloud was minute. I mean, the doses were nothing. You could see them. See, the thing about radiation is that we can see everything. We can see one atom disintegrating. Okay, you can't see one atom of mercury. You need a billion atoms of mercury to see it with a mass spec. Okay, but you can see one atom. That means you always see radiation, right? Because there's background and everything else. We can tell what kind of radiation is coming, from what kind of element. And in fact, it was first seen in Poland. In fact, the guy that I hired at Los Alamos was the guy that first see the Chernobyl cloud from his radiochemistry laboratory in Warsaw. But he wasn't allowed to say anything because it was still the Soviet Union at that time. So the guy in Sweden was the first one to announce it. Okay, but he was the first one to see it. And again, the doses were so low that it was no big deal, but everyone freaked out. Of course, everyone freaked out because we've been telling them since World War II to freak out. So they did.
Yeah. So I just want to toss in here real quick, and you may make reference to this later on downstream. So if we're going to talk about the safety of nuclear, one of the things we need to do is talk about it in comparison to the other sources of energy that we've got, like coal and oil and so on and so forth. And of course, literally thousands, even millions of people die from those energy sources. So I think that's an important perspective to have.
Yes, yes. Risk is incredibly important, but it's incredibly difficult to think of. And it's all relative. Okay, you never talk about risk as an absolute. You say relative to what?
Right.
Okay, so the danger from nuclear is about the risk is about the same as being hit by a meteorite. Okay, you just don't worry about that. You don't worry about that. Okay, I mean it's real. A couple of people throughout history have been hit by meteorites, but like five. Okay, so it's just nothing you need to worry about. Crossing the street in Tacoma with the light is 5,000 more times riskier than nuclear waste disposal.
Yeah, there's this old expression, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. And I think that kind of plays in here is, people are very accustomed to walking across the street and they don't give a second thought to that risk.
Right, right.
But they don't understand the ins and outs of nuclear power, and so they're afraid of that.
Right, right. In fact, food poisoning. Food poisoning kills 5,000 people a year, okay? Nuclear doesn't kill anyone.
Yeah.
All right. So, but see, it's the potential. All you have to do is mention the word nuclear and a mushroom cloud goes off in everyone's head. And it's hard to stop that because we have purposefully done that. All right. Now, weapons, weapons are bad. Weapons are bad. But they have nothing to do with nuclear power.
Okay. So we've done two accidents. What's the third accident that we want to talk about?
Three Mile Island. And nothing happened there at all. I mean, the radiation didn't even pass the fence of the boundary of the site. I mean, it was nothing. And everyone freaked out again. I mean, the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania called for every pregnant woman to leave the state. I mean, can you believe that? And of course, that caused huge amount of fear and panic. And it's like, why? There was no risk to them. Nothing ever got out. And it was a stuck valve. We don't have those kind of valves anymore. But that was it. It was a stuck valve. And they fixed it. And so, the fuel partially melted. So the fuel in the core. So we stopped it. We could have fixed it, but okay, we didn't. No big deal.
So we may talk about this a little more down line, but what you're talking about here in terms of public perception, I mean, it is real and it's having a very significant impact on our energy future. And so I know you're a scientist, but what do we do about that?
Right. And that's the bottom line. Humans are funny. William Churchill said, Americans will do everything possible wrong. Americans will always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the wrong things.
Yeah, right.
so something has to happen. We have to start having rolling blackouts, which unfortunately we're going to have beginning in about 2026 around the country because we're not ready. We're closing all these coal plants and there's too much energy that we depend on that. And when people buy, when a state like Washington State runs low on energy, projections, they buy coal energy from the surrounding states, Montana, Idaho, Utah, Oregon. Those plants are all going to be closed by 2030. Our own coal plant, the last one's going to be closed by 2025. So what happens when we need energy? We can't get it anymore from the surrounding states because they're going to be looking for energy because they closed all their coal plants. What are they going to, get it from BC, get it from Mexico? I mean, California is struggling trying to buy energy from other states because they can't meet their own demand. So again, we're just doing the wrong thing. We're not planning correctly. And you need to plan. When you shut down a coal plant, you need to plan what's going to replace that. And it's not going to be wind.
Well, let's start breaking it down a little bit. So, and talking about the concerns that people have. Now, you've talked about the safety issue significantly here. And I think that, the stats are pretty convincing. But let's talk about some of the other things that people are concerned about. And one of the biggest ones of those is nuclear waste, radioactive right. waste. So let's right. go there. Tell us about nuclear right. waste.
So nuclear waste is easy to handle. I've handled it myself for 40 years. Easy to dispose of. I was down at WIPP for 10 years, actually putting nuclear waste into the ground in the right rock. You put it in the right rock, it's a piece of cake. It's
Excuse
simple.
Me for interrupting, but I think yeah. you just used an acronym, WIPP.
Ah, yes, WIPP, the Waste Isolation. The Waste Isolation Pilot Project. It's no longer pilot. It's an actual deep underground nuclear repository designed and built for everything, including spent fuel and high-level waste, low-level waste. It was only licensed and permitted for transuranic waste, which is bomb waste, plutonium, uranium, americium, stuff like that.
Okay, quick question. So yes. who licensed it and why did they restrict it to those things?
Politics. So let me back up a little and kind okay. of go over nuclear waste. So nuclear okay. waste, there's four categories of nuclear waste in America, a little different in Europe because they don't have much bombs. We have all the bombs. So spent nuclear fuel from commercial reactor. Okay, that's the highest level. High level waste, which is only bomb waste. And it's bomb waste with a lot of radioactive material that gives off gamma rays. So, it's penetrating. Now, alpha and beta, alpha won't even pass your dead skin cells. Okay. So you could hold plutonium in your hand. No big deal. Okay. You'd have to powder it and breathe it in. Even eating it doesn't do anything. So that's alpha.
Quick question for you. Where does bomb waste come from? I mean, why is there bomb waste?
From like Hanford, from making the bombs, from the making of nuclear weapons.
So okay? It's like leftover, there was a recipe and there was something yeah. left over?
So that's a good point. So if you want to make a bomb, okay, it's either a uranium or plutonium bomb.
Okay.
Or it's a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb that has trigger is plutonium. Okay, so again, you need uranium or plutonium. Uranium-235, plutonium-239. And it has to be all 235 and all plutonium-239, okay? To do that, you take a weapons reactor, which is graphite moderated, not water moderated, graphite moderated, and you put your fuel into the reactor for 6 months only. You have to take it out after 6 months, because if you leave it in there like commercial fuel for 6 years, you breed in, you form a bunch of neutron poisons that prevent the chain reaction from going on. Okay, so if you breed in all these elements, and uranium 238 becomes plutonium 239, and then it accepts a neutron and it becomes plutonium 240. So you have all these things going on during the reaction. And in a commercial reactor, who cares? In a bomb reactor, though, no, you can't have that because you can't separate plutonium 240 from plutonium 239. And so 240 will scarf up all your neutrons, and the plutonium 239 will not fission. Okay, so your bomb will be a dud. So you have to take it out after 6 months out of a weapons reactor, and then quickly dissolve it up and put it through a series of steps to separate the plutonium-239 that you want, okay? And there are five major steps. And the first two steps, you get out all the junk, all the fission products, the pieces of the split atom, 235 split atom. And they're all, they're all little pieces, right? They're parts of the atom as it's split in half, and they're unequal pieces. And so you get all this mishmash, and that becomes high level waste because it has all the gamma emitters in it. Okay. Then you put it through some polishing steps to get out the uranium with it. You then put back into new fuel, and then the plutonium, which you make your bombs out of. So every waste of each of those steps has its own, huge tank at Hanford, okay, million gallon tank, right? So we, it started out as high level waste, And then you have a bunch of transuranic waste, which is this, the polishing step to polish up the plutonium. And all they're all alpha emitters, so they just go in true tanks called true transuranic waste. So anyway, so you have spent nuclear fuel commercial reactors, high-level waste from the first two steps of bomb making. This is high-level waste. The transuranic waste from the other three steps of making bombs, and then low-level waste.
So I want to ask a quick question here. So we talk about the Iranians and with nuclear for electricity versus for weapons, and I think we're all familiar with this notion of weapons grade.
Right.
And so is what you just described, is that the refining process whereby you get weapons grade material?
No, that's when you get weapons grade plutonium. Okay, only. Okay. Uranium, you don't need a reactor. You want to just take natural uranium ore, which you mine just like iron ore. You smelt it just like iron ore. You get something called yellow cake, which is pure uranium-308, uranium oxide. But that is 99.3% uranium-238. It's only 0.7% uranium-235. To have a bomb, you need it to be all 235. So you need to take a huge amount of yellow cake, right? Dissolve it up in acid, turn it into a gas, uranium hexafluoride, and put it down 30,000 centrifuge tubes. Now, uranium-235 slightly denser than 238. I'm sorry, slightly lighter than 238. So it goes towards the center. Uranium-238 goes towards the outside of the center. And then you bleed off the center over and over again at over 30,000 high-speed centrifuges until you've enriched your gas almost all uranium-235. It has to be above 93.5%. So, right, and then you make your uranium bomb. Now, Iran was doing that, okay? They hadn't gotten over 20% though. And at the same time, the Russians were building them a power reactor at Bushehr. We didn't care. Who cares? You can't make a bomb out of commercial fuel, so no one cared. Okay? You know the difference between a weapons reactor and a commercial reactor. I mean,
yeah, gotcha.
You know that. Now, at the same time, North Korea, wisely from a strategic perspective, you know, forget about uranium because it's uranium bombs takes more uranium to get the same blast as plutonium. Plutonium is more efficient, fissioner, splitter. So you can't missileize uranium. You have to drop it from an airplane, okay, or drive it in a truck or something. Okay, you want to put it on a missile, you need it to be plutonium, which is much lighter. Okay, so since North Korea was wanting bombs for missiles, of course, to hit the United States and South Korea and Japan, they went for plutonium right off the bat. We knew that too, okay? And, you know, their reactor was very small, and then they built a larger one, and now they have, you know, the equivalent of 30 plutonium bombs.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. Keeping in mind for the moment the magnitudes of difference Dr. Konka points out between weapons-grade fissionable material and that used for fuel in the electricity generation. Next episode of Climate Talk, we'll conclude our conversation with Dr. Konka on nuclear waste. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. It's a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So, until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.